maybe I'll ask right now for my fellow illustrious, fantastic fellow panelists just to introduce themselves and say, as I said, we don't want for this panel to deal in too narrow a way with the journal. We really want to talk about the question of feminist scholarship. But it would be maybe interesting for everybody who's up here to just mention something about their relationship to the journal and then the larger issue of feminist performance and scholarship on it. So maybe Karen, if you want.
Okay. I'm Karen Finley, and I am a feminist and an artist performer, and I'm also a big fan of the journal. I love the journal. And that is the main reason why I'm here. I'm also on the faculty at NYU in the Department of Art and Public Policy. And that's why I'm here.
Thank you. I'm Alicia Arizon, and I've been for the past 2 years, I think 2 or 3 years, a part of the editorial board. Mm-hmm. I'm also a feminist. I'm a lesbian feminist. Let me add that. I teach at UC Riverside, and I teach in women's studies. I'm also the chair of women's studies, but my entire research is about performance, theater, and gender and sexuality studies. I'm grading my students right now as I am in the hotel to turning grades on Tuesday and gender theory. And it's interesting issues that I'm reading that I was thinking about the class, about today's forum when we deal with issues of feminism and feminist performance. So I'm very happy to be here.
My name is Beth Kirchen, and I'm on the editorial board in the collective, and I, as a master's student at performance studies at NYU, I started to attend meetings and became more involved, and little by little got more and more involved, and now I'm the performance reviews editor, so if anyone wants to review a performance and submit it, please do. I think my attraction to the journal has been the way in which it has invited scholarship and practitioners to have a space together. And I'm really excited about this new section that we have, Ampersand. And I'm a scholar practitioner. I'll be performing at the party tonight at 10 p.m. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited. And I'm a big fan of the journal and really invested in it. And I'm currently in the last stages of writing my dissertation. And I'm writing about Cynthia Hopkins, who's an extraordinary hybrid musician, dancer, writer, performer. So that's it.
Thank you. And what is her name? And Barbara Browning. So I've been on the collective, a member of the collective for a long time. The journal was founded in 1983 by graduate students in the Department of Performance Studies at NYU, and it was formed as a feminist collective, and we continue to operate as such, anachronistic as that may seem, which is one of the things that we thought we might want to talk about today, which is to say that work performed as a collective, and specifically as a feminist collective. We all know that sometimes that presents certain kinds of organizational challenges to getting work done and to getting, for example, an issue out, but it also presents certain kinds of opportunities. And as Beth was saying, the collaboration, the mixing on the board of practitioners and scholars and the dialogue that goes on there is very important to us, but it's also very important to us that graduate students, faculty members of NYU, of other institutions, people who are participating from a distance increasingly, that there's a dialogue and a way in which there's an ostensibly non-hierarchical structure, but I think it's very important for us to put some pressure on that and wonder if this is one of the things that we thought it might be interesting to ask you about your experiences with this as well, and to talk a little bit about ours, whether in fact changes in institutional structures, that is academic institutional structures, publishing structures, make it more important for us to continue to operate as a collective, put certain pressures on that kind of structure for creating scholarship. So that's something that we are interested in talking about. The journal was self-published for 23 years and then was acquired by Routledge, and that has meant that there are certain kinds of institutional things, that parameters on things, including what the issues look like, and we used to sometimes spiral bind and sometimes have them long and skinny and sometimes have them all different shapes and sizes and different colors, and now they follow the Routledge format. But there are other things that are actually much more significant than the format, which have to do with the way that we get scholarship done. So that is one thing, but I think probably for most people in the room, the bigger questions are the ones that we would really like to address, which is what kind of work are we looking at, and how are we looking at it, which is to say, if you look at our website, womeninperformance.org, when we talk about our mission, a sort of shortened version of that is extending and reformulating notions of gender and performance, which is to say that we always want for our subject matter, for what we're actually thinking about, and the ways that we do scholarship, to be constantly evolving, and for us to stretch our notions about what those two terms, women and performance, mean and how we want to address them. The collective distributed to everyone who's up here a couple of prompts regarding these questions, and I think it might be best to begin with the biggest question, which is really what constitutes women and performance today, what kind of performance work is going on that actually addresses feminist issues. And we're in Toronto, and I'm very aware that we don't want to be U.S.-centric, we don't want to be New York-centric, and we really don't want to be New York Times-centric, so my apologies for all of those things, but we did circulate a piece, and I don't know I sort of feel like it might be a little bit of a straw man, but it is kind of a point of departure, possible point of departure. There was a piece in the Times that some people may have seen that Sam Tenenhaus wrote after the Amy Bishop, you remember, went on the shooting rampage having to do with tenure. And he published a piece in the arts section of the Times that sort of said, why is it that feminist performance today continues to sort of think about the issues of violence as violence enacted on women as opposed to women's capacity for violence? And I think many of us found it an unsatisfactory piece for a variety of reasons, but it did. It was a kind of a prompt for us to think about what it means to do feminist performance today. And I hate to kind of toss the ball to you, Karen, but because Karen's work was actually addressed in the piece, would you mind sort of just initiating thoughts about? About feminist performance and how it might be changing, or how you see your work evolving?
Sure. I think that responding first, I'd like to just say I'm listening to the idea of responding in a collective, and I think that in terms of my career, I've been more thinking about my vision for others. And I think that's the way that I primarily have been motivated. And I was thinking about this, first of all, I just want to talk about that first, is because at the time when I was going to school or coming of age, women were only represented in the museum. I think I had one female teacher at the Art Institute, a San Francisco Art Institute. So the lack of being in, you want to say, leadership was definitely at that time in the 70s important. But of course, you know, like Judy Chicago, I was thinking about, and there's many ways of thinking about collectives. Mm-hmm. And I feel that, so you can think of, okay, a collective can be in this traditional way, everyone's in a room, and then you're giving your point of view, and then you make, but there's other ways, and I've decided that, I think that my, if you want to say success, meaning that I think that I contributed to the field, is based on collectives, series of collectives that start young, whether it's going to be family, community. I think community is definitely collective. And I feel that the way that, and even now being at the university, you know, there can be different collectives and different ways of strategizing. So I just wanted to be saying that, in terms of this the article, it was strange, Barbara, because I get the, so I'd like to just talk about that, the fact that I'm asked to be on a panel, and then I'm thinking, I have this, I am imagining where I could be on the panel where I'm not talking about myself.
You don't have to.
Right, but that's what, and then I have to be reading the article that I didn't want to read because I'm in it, because it's very strange. So I'd like to just talk about that first, right? When you are a performer and then you're talked about and there's this public idea and there's this whole conversation about you and your motivations and everything, and how do you respond to that? So I want to think about that, the performing of that, you know, mm-hmm. and how I've had to negotiate that and how I actually struggle with that. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to read it. Because I had been performing, what the article about is about the woman who is a killer. And then, of course, they bring up Marina Abramović and myself in that context, which is really disturbing for me. Like the idea that, okay, you have a killer, you know, woman killer, next, you know, women artist. And it's written by, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of like more of a traditional, you know, kind of way. I look at it, who writes it, and I don't know, I think Sam might be Tanner House, a man. So immediately I go into that thing. And I kind of like the way I've coped, I kind of like disregard it. Because if I don't, if I can't, then I have a lot of things. So that's, but here are now the points that I made. You know, fascinating, so many of the examples in the articles are bringing up men. You know, like, I have the article, Scorsese, all of these males, Norman Mailer, Truman Capote, Don DeLillo, Robert Stone, Sam Peckinpah, Francis Ford Coppola, you know, continuing going on. And then, of course, bringing up Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. They love to do that. And... and so it's strange, so I'm cited, and then during this time that I'm performing, when this article came out, I'm performing a performance as Jackie Kennedy. That's what I've been doing, where I've been performing is Jackie Kennedy looking back at her images of trauma and her kind of analyzing and releasing these images of trauma, all right? But he is not seeing that. He's still seeing the fact that the female body is the criminal site, the act of the crime. And so that has not been able to. So that's painful for me that still then at 54, that these similar issues are still going on and that I'm not, you know, so that. So it becomes the imagined past yearning of me by the journalist and then the disappointment of me in the present. So I think it's not just me, but basically that I'm occupying this space for the female. That I am not speaking about necessarily female violence in the way that satisfies him, but the viewing of violence. And that in this piece, I'm talking about the release of the images of trauma. So that is what interested me, of thinking about the fact that I you can substitute as the female, disappointed him with the idea of an imagined past that probably didn't even occur. And so that was what interested me. Thank you.
Did you
yes. I'm going to respond in regards to the collectivity. I think it's very important And when I received some of the questions, I did wrote 3 pages. I'm not going to read them, okay? But I do want to read a paragraph here because I want to invoke Jill Dolan's notion of utopia. And let me just read it to respond to that and to the notion of... what I say here is if feminist studies resulted from activist challenge to the very institution, the institutionalization of knowledge, performance studies, I believe, must be grounded in embodied actions performed somehow socially, breaking down disciplinary boundaries. So I really think about how interdisciplinarity is very important to the issues that you're talking about, the journal. So how it breaks down disciplinary boundaries to situate as an interdisciplinary discipline. And, so in this context, I would like to share and invoke here Jill Dolan's beliefs and hopes regarding the necessity of performance to serve as a tool for social change. So I find her use of utopia a cornerstone proposed, especially regarding the function of feminist performance in society. So I agree with her that in order for feminist performance to change the world, we must write about it, teach it, and circulate it. I'm trying to read here because it's so dark, and circulate it as an idea, a commodity. Sometimes I think we should think about an idea as a commodity and practice of faith and belief. And I wanted to allude to that. And I also, and I like to add, because these are some of her ideas that she said in her utopia, but let me add that I like to add that in order to develop a feminist cultural practice and theory that works towards productive social change, it is necessary to understand that representation is a political issue and to analyze women's subordination within and it really helps to really analyze women's subordinations within patriarchal forms of representations. And I think it's very important when we think about, you know, to think about how we can challenge and end women's subordinations in patriarchal cultures, I think. And so anyway, I wanted to bring that because when I read the question about collectivity, right away it took me to the notion of utopia and seeing performance as how do we really practice, write, and theorize, you know, of feminist performance as a tool for social change. Mm-hmm. And I think that's collectivity for me, it is that, you know, how can we really work towards social change? Because when I think of that, of course, I ended up writing 3 pages of the questions, but I'm not going to go over anyway, but I find this important because Jill Dolan's supposed to be here today, and she's been an inspiration to a lot. I mean, she's been an inspiration to my work, to everyone's work, I think. Mm-hmm. She's been foundational, and I want to make sure I mention her work here.
Well, picking up from what you were saying about we have to write, we have to make work that addresses... what we see and what's happening. And just responding to what Karen was saying too, I found that the article was in some ways not sort of seeing the larger body of work by these two performance artists, and were in some ways kind of extrapolating as Karen was talking about. And what was interesting to me about both the Jackie Look, this new piece that Karen has been doing, and the Abramovitz retrospective was that both of those things that are very current seem to be highly teachable types of interactions with the public. And there were many times when I went to MoMA and just kind of sat and listened and watched and just found so many people sort of explaining to one another what they thought was going on or trying to understand. And, you know, when you think about what the museum does with the placards and So I found it really fascinating that we're at this moment where also with the Jackie look, where it's in some ways mimicking a lecture with slides and talking back to images and sort of using the lecture format as a mode of performance. I just found it really fascinating that it just also in relationship to what we as a journal are trying to do in terms of have participation and also put things out there in the world for people to think about. I just found that his view was just so narrow and troubling. But I'm curious maybe to talk about just the quote-unquote teachable aspects of the journal and something like the retrospective and even with Karen's recent work.
I would like to bring up the idea that when you have, I'm going to say, avant-garde, a work that's going to be marginalized, and then it goes into the popular culture, and how that is calculated, how that is mediated by the public. And it's I don't think that it's ever smooth, really. And then if it is smooth, then the person's a sellout. So, and I think what I just want to backtrack just for the idea of the New Yorkization of this is that we're talking about Marina Abramović's exhibition, Retrospect, that was at MoMA. And I'd like to also bring up that this article, which I have a copy of here by Sam Tenenhaus in The Times, which is bringing up her work in that article, is that I'd like to talk about just for a second what also was going on, is that there were many articles, tabloid articles, on her performance. Talking about the sexualization of, because there is nudity in the performance. I'm sure all of you know about it, but just to, and then people would be walking past, as we know, the performance where there's the nude couple, man and woman, walking past the bodies. And how that became a tabloid sensation as well at the same time. So that's what I just wanted to, I think that that's what this is part of as well, is that the Times, in terms of journalism, being able to participate within this sort of phenomenon, tabloid, and their participation in that as well.
I'm trying to figure out a way to phrase this, because I think that there are related, it's interesting, I hadn't really anticipated that there would be related issues between the question of how a collective functions and this particular issue of representations in the media of what contemporary feminist performance is doing. But I was thinking as you were speaking, Karen, when you first spoke about women in a position of leadership and what it means to do solo work in relation to this question of collectivity. And sorry, because I'm going to connect the dots in a second. It'll sound like very diverse dots, but... sorry again, I'm going to cite another New York Times article, but it was one that I actually really loved, which was Holland Cotter's piece about Emily Dickinson, which appeared shortly after Sam Tenenhaus's unsatisfactory article, in which Holland Cotter was talking about Emily Dickinson and said, oh, everybody thinks that she was isolated. She was, you know, they're doing her little thing, and that she was, you know, the spinster, and she was so delicate, like this delicate little flower. And he says, look at this line, if I had a mighty gun, I think I'd shoot the human race. And, you know, he was sort of making this argument that actually she was an incredibly powerful person who was, you know, in doing this solo work, you know, sort of the icon, in fact, of sort of someone really concentrated on doing her work, that, in fact, she was expressing. And, you know, Tenenhaus has got this weird preoccupation, like, why aren't there more people, you know, women artists, have, you know, actually expressing.
Well, I have the article.
But Emily Dickinson actually was, you know, and Holland Cotter was picking up on that, like, hello, you know, there are ways in which women artists have been for a long time producing work of tremendous expressions of agency and power and sometimes anger and sometimes, you know, other kinds of agency, which are not necessarily, I mean, it's obviously a metaphorical violence, but it's extremely powerful. So this notion of solo work, and I think that is one of the things, even as I say, you know, yes, we're a feminist collective and we do these things together, there are also ways in which it's very important to continue to think about why it is important to consider what solo work does for women and can do for women. But, you know, and you were mentioning the pedagogical and teachable moments in these performances, and I've sort of seen your work, Karen, evolving in ways in which it seems to me that the pedagogical has really become very important. And I know that, you know, as your colleague at NYU, I know that teaching and sort of nurturing other emerging performers and scholars in the world of feminism is very important. Yeah.
Can I
please
that?
Please.
Yeah, I think that's one of the greatest accomplishments in the feminist performance is the one woman show, the body, how the body basically is a social agent, how the body alone itself represents in a way, the struggles of the collective body of, you know, knowledge in feminism. So I think that's the power, I think, in performance studies, in feminist performance studies. One woman show, in a way, gave a lot of, going back to the idea that you don't need to have three bodies performing the collective, but it's just one body that can really give us the sense of what collectivity of women's experience, body and body experience is. So I think I agree, if I understand what you're trying to say. You know, that is for me, I seen the solo performer as a great instigator in feminist performance, I think.
One of the things that always moves me about PSI is the number of performers who are actually engaging with scholars, and particularly feminist performers who come out and actually really want to have that kind of dialogue, which is fairly unusual in the arts to see practitioners that engaged with the people who are actually writing them about them, and to have that then inflect performance. And Beth, as somebody who is both a performer and completing a PhD in performance studies, is one of these, is, you know, exemplary of a kind of straddling those worlds. Would you like to say?
I feel like I'm standing on the horse. That's running. I think the challenging tension between those boundaries is what makes it productive, and that's why it's magnetic for me to be in a space like the journal, in a space like performance studies as a department, to try to negotiate those two realms, and they both feed and complicate one another. Something that is just coming up for me, which is a pop cultural reference, and I'm sorry if this will create a segue, but maybe it'll be interesting, is that I also teach writing to first-year Tisch School of the Arts students, and one of my students this past term did a paper on Lady Gaga, and she was really intrigued about what performance art was, because in a lot of interviews, Lady Gaga was saying, you know, I'm indebted, in a way she was very reverential to performance art, but at the same time her use of that term was clearly very simplistic and unclear. But I also found it interesting with Sam Tenenhaus's article how he wasn't also able to think about, you know, in some ways he was looking at pop cultural references like Glenn Close with Fatal Attraction, but yet he's kind of zeroed in on the avant-garde and didn't kind of look at how the avant-garde has also, you know, in complicated ways, fed pop culture. And, you know, I don't think there would be, without the work of Karen Finley and her colleagues, you know, the vagina monologues and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like, in a way, he had this whole claim about being dated, and yet the way that he was sort of perceiving feminist performance himself seemed very kind of stuck in time to me.
And thinking about collectives, which I want to be part of a collective to think about something to do in response to BP, the oil spill.
No.
And, you know, I think that many times collectives sometimes form in terms of cultural movements when there is actually, you work together as a problem. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really thinking about that, and I think I'd like to be part of a collective. So I'm putting that out there, and if anyone is interested,
join the club after
thinking about that, what would be
I mean, that is, you know, so thinking about that, you know, in terms of, so that's how would I, and then what Barbara and I went to actually last month was a collective that I think, in terms of what performance that I've seen, is the Two-Headed Calf, that Room for Cream, mm-hmm. which is the a collective of women, a lesbian soap opera that goes on once a month, and that is my favorite performance work that's going on right now. I'm really sorry that I missed it. I think it was the 9th was, so it's once a month. I really strongly recommend that, and I think that that's an example in terms of the New York Times or certain media that is ignoring. You know, like I was looking, they're a collective, they're incredible, they've been around for a couple of years. It's a small town in, I think, in Massachusetts, sort of be like in Amherst, and then they work right together, perform it, and it's, Barbara could probably explain it more, but I think it's fantastic, and it's a collective, and they work, and they really consider themselves a collective. So I want to give that example.
They're great.
I'm wondering if people in the audience have responses and or questions or provocations. Yeah.
I guess just to recommend your position.
Thank you.
I've been an arts critic in Miami for a long time, and I find it really interesting. I am the New York Times reader, so I don't want to be in Miami. but I find it interesting that the discussion would center around an article from the Times as opposed to one from Women in Performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that speaks to the power of the popular press, I think, in sort of setting the agenda in the ways that the arts are thought of. Things like the New York Times is ignoring something, just as a quick note, that sounds like something they would love to cover, that has contacted them, but if someone feels that it's important to talk about that, it would be simple to get them to write that piece. That's the kind of piece that arts critics are interested in writing, and I think even at our Misguided, we're really interested in having a conversation with the artists, and I'm thinking of lots of pieces where the artists freak out, you know, about how wrong I was, and how awful my point of view is, and that's led to these dialogues that have been really productive. And finally, following up on that, right now I've been hired to edit a dance criticism site in Miami that's funded by the Knights Foundation, and we're trying to come up with a new model for arts criticism and dance criticism in particular, which tends to be about women or gay men in performance, because that's who's producing, at least in our community, dance work. And part of the model has to do with what if it's not just the professional critic with one perspective, but what if that critic is working in relationship to the audience members and to the performers? Mm-hmm. And how can we use new technologies like the internet to create a kind of collective criticism of the arts that's feeding back into the performers in a much more diffuse way than the old model?
Right. This is Celeste Tracy Delgado, and just if I could ask you, I forgot to say this, when, if people have questions or comments, if you could just identify yourselves, if you choose to do so, even. Thank you. Yeah.
I just wanted to put out there that On the Boards, which is a theater in Seattle, has this very productive community that does blog the boards, and they have audience members write reviews, and there's a lot of give and take, and you could look at blog the boards, and it's wonderful. The kind of investment and the give and take that occurs online is really extraordinary.
It sounds a little bit like Hotels.com with the reviews.
And that's the challenge. We have a site called NeverWatchAlone.com, which is a site for the audience to write criticism, and the question is, how is it different from Yelp or Hotels.com? Mm-hmm. And the challenge is, how do you then do the pedagogical work of giving people tools to write about the arts? And we do that partly by working through universities. So we have 4 universities in the area that are having their students go out and do this work and publish it publicly. Mm-hmm. And we're also working on this thing called the Critics Engine that will sort of provide a lot of prompts to get people to dig deeper in their writing. Mm-hmm.
Just to spring off of this, and then I'll ask for other questions or comments, but interesting that I noticed much of the work that's going on at the conference now is about how the new communications technologies are opening up possibilities. Obviously, people have been paying somewhat more attention during the conference to collaborative or responsive or collective work, sometimes which is solo work that is at the same time in conversation with, that is to say, like YouTube videos that are created in response to YouTube videos created in response to, so that kind of, those kinds of collective networks that allow simultaneously for individual work and a sense of collectivity. But obviously, in terms of scholarship, there are also new scholarship and critical work and journalism and ways of writing about and thinking about, talking about performance that are being expanded by some of these technologies. And once again, it's tempting just to be celebratory and talk about this as a democratizing moment, and we might also want to think about what some of the risks are and what happens to both the artistic work and the critical work that comes out of these forums. Other comments? Yes, sir.
Yeah. I'm really interested in the tensions between the collective and the individual and how we hold it occurring. And I was thinking of reading writings by Glock and Nonert, who are there, I'm not sure if they still are, the curators of Manifesta in Germany, where they were talking about collective, the term collective, and how this carries, at least in parts of Eastern Europe and Europe maybe in general, negative connotations because of communist and communism disease. And kind of putting it in relation to terms like community or how what other terms might be there that don't carry these negative connotations. But I'm interested in how, whether these connotations do exist in the States or in parts of the world that are far from communism or have very different relationships to communism. And I was also thinking, I was recently interviewing art hackers collective in Switzerland called Bitnik, who operate as a collective, as a lot of hackers do. And they were saying that what they find fascinating is that they do not want to give the press their individual names, because their practice comes very much out of discourses that are collective and collaborative. But there's a strong resistance from the press to not publish individual names. So they always try to find out who is the one person they were being attributed to, rather than reference the collective as a collective. So just confirm this in terms of the tensions between them.
I hesitate to say this because it's me and my paper at this conference, but actually I gave a paper that was on two choreographies that took place in the streets in New York last November. Both of which were, all of the dancers were dressed in trench coats, and in one case it was a Turkish choreographer who was trying to invoke, it was about the 20-year anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and for her the trench coat sort of represented this oppressive history of communism, and in the other one, which was the opening performance of the Performa Festival of 2009, everybody in trench coats. One of the creators of the piece said, "Oh well, people may look at this and think it's a flash mob for Banana Republic." So in the one case, this collection of people identically dressed was like represented communism, and for the other, it represented late capitalism, like hyper capitalism, and it was strange. And then what were the resonances of these two choreographies? They were like produced a week apart in New York on the street, you know, and yet resonating in these very different ways, which I think sort of speaks to this. I would say just a very brief and compressed and probably superficial response is that the term collective tends to resonate in a U.S. context, and particularly if you attach the word feminist to it, in a way that has little to nothing to do with that. But I do think that and one of the things that we talk about a lot at the journal, and that we talk a lot about and try to think about in PSI, little I, big I, international, is that we need to, and that's why I apologized and hemmed and hawed to say, oh, we're going to start by talking about New York, is to understand that these things do resonate and have very different histories. The idea of what collective work does, all of that has very different resonances in different places and with different histories. So thank you for raising that.
Can I say something in defense of I'm partly, I mean, in terms of the social studies, so I mean the
Absolutely. I don't mean to. Absolutely.
Don't go into that kind of simplified questions about the East and the collective. I mean, and the collective is a leftist tradition.
Yeah.
It's absolutely to be defended. And that's why I didn't actually, you might perhaps have another take on that. It's a reaction.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that when the activists, artists actually moved from the slogan, do it yourself, that was around for a long time, and when the neoliberals and the right wing took over that kind of thing, okay, they don't need any funding, they can do that by themselves, so they changed the slogan, do it together. So this is, don't go into this kind of simplified
discussions
about,
I would agree, and,
70s, and so I'm not a specialist on Eastern Europe, but I come from Eastern Europe myself. But I think that it's an interesting thing about collectivities or collectives in Eastern Europe, because the redefinition of the left, I mean, when the wall went down, and we really can have also different opinions about that, the Western Germany and what used to be the Eastern Germany, because I can actually agree with the Western definition of how that so-called reunification came about. So I'm not necessarily everybody is still, you know, celebrating the
But
the interesting thing is that the extremely nationalist kind of reactionary strange politics that came out of the post-Soviet, because we are now talking about the Soviet definition of what socialism or communism should be about, and that was a kind of different notion. The interesting thing in Eastern Europe today is that you have the neo-Nazis, you have the neo-fascists, and the extreme nationalism, and that we already have as a European tradition also in the Western Europe. So that's for sure. But there is also the redefinition of the left, and of those traditions actually that are very different for the artistic practices, because they never had that because of the war that the leftist artists and feminists actually have in the West. So this is now, it's an interesting thing if you go to those art spaces today, and after this short celebration of capitalism in the early 90s, hey, well, now we're part of the West. Now all of a sudden people started to realize that it was not just, you know, the kind of thing that the wealth was coming to somebody or to everybody just like that. So I would say also that in Eastern European artistic communities and collectives, the leftist part of that is now redefining itself and finding also its institutionalized basis for organizing colleagues, political parties, but also the arts, for those of us who are interested in both politics and the arts.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very tricky and it's a very infected European kind of discussion. And not to defend the Soviet state, I still want to defend the leftist socialist tradition. And that is also where I place the feminist tradition.
Right. Thank you. That's very, very helpful. And by no means, I think probably that neither of us was. I think we're in agreement. In fact, that my reading of the, of course, was very foreshortened. But my reading of that particular choreography, the first choreography that I mentioned, was not an embrace of the sort of happy narrative of the fall of the wall. It's actually was more critical. But so indeed, I think we're probably in agreement about that. But it is interesting, I think, also to raise the question of connections between, as well as differentiations between ways that the term collective resonates in these different contexts and different histories, which are both implicated and yet also distinct.
But, this is great that you are, you know, saying that that you're including that in our conversation, because in feminist performance or feminism, the use of collectivity here in the United States is really a tool to resist the individualism that exists in our society. You know, even if you think about in the last presidential campaign, when Obama was accused of this radical activist, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, where is it came from that? I mean, because he was just someone that, I mean, in the past cared for a community and the community work. And so in our society, using the term collectivity is a form of resistance to the individualism that we are bombarded with, I think. And we women in feminism are not that it could be a very romantic idea, especially in feminism, because there are so many feminisms, right? And feminism never came to agree with, and it is the beauty of it. But the notion of collectivity is really a form of resistance here to this, to our individualist society. And I don't know, I want to make sure that we see
right.
that. Don't you think?
Yes, I think so. That's...
Yeah. So anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Gender studies class for the first time, I think they were second year-ish gender studies class in Montreal to primarily non-arts-based students, accountants, business students, etc. And I mean, not to ignore a lot of the discussion that's going on, and I think the issue is very, very complex, but the sort of stock question had been, you know, so why the hell is what you're teaching us important? What possible relevance does this have in our lives? We live in the age of post-feminism, blah, blah, blah. You know, that's an entirely different discussion, clearly. But I was just wondering, and this is a question for any of the panelists or anyone in the audience who wants to respond, like, what kind of sort of on-paper responses would you give to a student that facilitate dialogue, don't shut down, and you don't make them feel ignorant for, you know, feeling that way, because those are feel very legitimate feelings. I mean, I don't but, and you know, and well, you know, encouraging dialogue and sort of exploring avenues for opening thought, I guess. So, I would like to respond to that.
I know it's a big question.
So last night I took the night off of the conference and watched two movies in my hotel. The first movie I watched was the Tina Fey Date Night. Tina Fey, she's one of my new heroes right now, but one of the narrative closures of the film was that Tina Fey didn't let her husband see Carol do anything, and really what and that part of the problem with their marriage was that she was too controlling and she didn't trust him to take over or he could take over. And of course the film resolves with her needing to shut up and let him do what he could do. And the film resolves with their marriage becoming exciting again because he proved he was a leader. Now, this is very embarrassing, but the second movie that I watched was Hot Tub Time Machine. And one of the things that happens in that film is that there's this African-American man character, and it's a movie about these three middle-aged men who come together and they go on a trip. It's a very formulaic, you know, romance kind of movie, except the really failed men. And one of the indications of this African-American man being so completely failed was that he had a hyphenated last name, and he'd taken his wife's last name. And then what happens, so this happens before the Hot Tub Time Machine happens, and then the Hot Tub Time Machine happens, and their lives change. And so only at the end of the movie happens is the African American man who had originally taken his wife's name and had a hyphenated name. It wasn't a mutual clinic, he just hyphenated his last name. And of course this was a sign of complete emasculation. Then when the film concludes and resolves and all of these men have their masculinity absolutely recuperated, and his masculinity is recuperated by him having the same wife but only having. And so, to me, those are two absolutely central moments in absolutely contemporary culture that shows that there is still a war on women, right? Mm-hmm. That there is still a war, there is still the only way for the world to kind of exist in this copacetic way is for men to be as powerful as possible and women to be as powerless as possible. And so anyways, that was just something that I was thinking about last night. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of the questions, and I don't need to monopolize conversation, but I would like to return to the role of women's and gender studies and feminist performance in Canada and elsewhere eventually. Mm-hmm.
Someone here.
My name is Ethan, and I'm a little question back to you. Just in response to the question about, you know, why people should care about, I don't know if your question was specifically about feminism or performance of women, but in any case, I mean, I think it's I've encountered that frequently too. My students sometimes express fatigue, or they say things like, you know, feminism is no longer relevant because we've already solved all the problems. You know, and I guess my responses to that are many. First of all, there's still a gender age gap. You know, things like, you can point to examples throughout the world or in your own country whereby, you know, women are constantly being, it's very valid to still fight the cause of feminism. I mean, the goal, I would say your first maybe point of attack might say, be to repeat that and say, no, we haven't solved the problems. And you can point to, you know, case studies that you can research. You know, I don't want to provide false information, so I'm not going to just generalize how women are under attack or something like that. In any case, you can point to case studies to refute that. But also, I guess it's a slippery slope because you don't want to portray women as disempowered, per se. I think it's important to point to the historical importance, the significance of second wave feminism, while also just, it's one of those things because people say I'm post-feminist or not feminist or, and, you know, second wave is done. It had its historical moment. It is a valid debate. I remain committed to the cause of feminism, you know, second wave, actually, I'll just say. So many movies fail the test, and you can do the same thing in plays. And it's very useful because it's very shocking. And what it really tests is simply whether the film or whatever is treating women like people. That's all it is. Do they talk to each other about things other than men? And you can
link to the film on the blog. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yes, here. Did, yeah.
Hi, I'm Lisa Otis from the University of Texas. I'm a student now, but I taught 3 years at the University of Puerto Rico, humanities, but with a very large feminist content. And what I would do is that at the beginning of the class, I asked the students, most of them didn't want to be there. It was a required course, so I asked them, why are you here and why is this important? And then I would ask that question at the end again. And very often, I think, even when they ask us this question, because I have asked that myself as a performer, for example, very much, why is this relevant? Why is this conference, what we discuss here, relevant? How are we, you know, changing the world? Should I be a doctor instead?
Other kind of doctor.
So, you know, this happens every 6 now it's like every year. So I am very passionate about the fact they're asking this question, but I think they also think about the answers. So turning the question around to them, and maybe not exactly if one student comes to you and not to that, but bring it to a discussion in the class. And even though my class was not about feminism, very often there were both young men and women who would come and say, thank you because you're making me think about things about gender that I never questioned before. So, and I love the grateful this.
You said bring men into the discussion?
Yes, the discussion. This is not to say to reject the term feminism. I think it's extraordinarily dangerous. But even the two examples that you brought up, Teal, we're talking about a certain crisis in masculinity, right? Not that we have to necessarily make our class about feeling sorry for the men in our classes, but I think that a lot of the rejection of feminism among the women in our classes, if you actually talk to them about it, is their fear of identifying with feminism because they will ultimately be rejected by the men who are in the room. So there's a performance going on there. Oh, no, I'm not a feminist either, right? Because we actually see, I find in my classes, it's the women who are performing the anti-feminism even more than them.
Yeah,
and so
we start talking about compulsory sexuality.
Right. But if you make it very clear from the outset of the class that this is a discussion that everybody that men are oppressed by the same system of gender, and you provide an opportunity for them to engage in the discussion, then some of those kinds of performances are obviated by that.
Which is, I hope you don't mind if I'm going to do this. One other thing that's happening in Canada is that women's studies programs, there's been this whole thing all year about women's studies programs closing and studies departments turning into programs. Women's studies programs and departments being their names being changed to women's and gender programs, gender studies programs, women's gender and sexuality programs, all of these things. And so there's been this real renewed backlash against women's studies in particular.
Right.
And I wanted to refer, Alicia, to what you were talking about in terms of Jill Dorn's work on utopian performance, in particular as a women's studies professor, which I am as well.
I wanted to get to what you were talking about asking, you know, how do we really practice, write, and theorize performance? How do we use feminist performance as a tool for social change? And so that prompted me, and then seeing Shauna Dempsey and Susan Bennett sitting beside each other reminded me of this several years ago now, Susan Bennett published, I think, the first article on Shauna and Lori's work. And in that article, one of the focuses of the article, if I recall correctly, was about how Shauna and Lori, doing this feminist work, would seek out their own audiences. And women's studies programs were one of those audiences. And what I want to do is ask about the status of women's studies in other places.
Right.
And also, I want to ask a question, particularly in Canada, where we don't have performance studies programs in departments in particular, I want to acknowledge that women's studies programs have been a site of promoting and supporting and generating scholarship and exposure and circulation for feminist inquiry performance in Canada. And I want to think about how we respond as artists and feminist scholars and queer scholars to the depletion and closing of women's and gender studies programs and departments in Canada. And how do we maintain collectivity, feminist collectivity across campuses to continue to bring artists to campus, to continue to pay artists to come to campus, and to continue to generate that scholarship without the institutionalized structure of a feminist, explicitly feminist department?
Right. Thank you so much. That's a really great issue. It's a very big question. It was partly addressed to Alicia, but I'd just like to say momentarily, because to also embrace this particular issue in the large, it was one of the things that the collective talked about in anticipation of this panel, because indeed, and when I said we're constantly expanding the terms women and performance, and of course this is constantly an issue for us, and in fact sometimes they're speaking of backlash is back and forth, right? Because our journal has increasingly published on issues of gender and sexuality that are not necessarily exclusively foregrounding women, however you want to, you know, how do you want to construe that
queer
term?
Theory.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then the concern is, well, if this is the one publishing space where, you know, that is specifically devoted to women and performance, what happens to the specificity? And sometimes it's kind of easy. We also sort of played around with a sort of aggressive, I would say, email that we received about a cover of one of our issues, and we decided we weren't going to address it. Now I'm telling you the story. We had the fantastic performer Richard Move, who dances as Martha Graham, was on the cover in a Martha Graham outfit doing it, and someone was concerned that on a cover of a journal called Women in Performance, Richard Move was featured on the cover, and what did that mean? So. You know, these kinds of things, these are issues absolutely within institutions, including publishing institutions, and these questions of how best to address it without immediately dismissing the question of what happens to the specificity of women. But Alicia, maybe you have a...
No, I really want to hear from them, but let me say something first in relation to the changes going on. Especially I'm from the UC system, a system that is sinking right now, right? And it's going through a lot of changes and transformation. Santa Barbara, it has a program on feminist studies, the first PhD now, titled Feminist Studies. UC Santa Cruz had proposed a PhD in transnational feminisms that hasn't been approved. Berkeley has a program now on gender, and ours is a pending for financial on gender and sexuality studies, a PhD too. So yes, right now we're sinking, so we don't know what's gonna happen with women's studies. But those transformations going on, you know, are everybody is, you know, I think the emergence of men's studies, I don't know how many of you have read that field. Women's studies and masculinity, transgender studies. I mean, how do you open the doors to new kinds of knowledges that don't have a place? And women's studies, we need to open that door. We need to open the door to a transgender male to female wanting to teach in women's studies. So the needs of being inclusive the needs of how the LGBTI, the intersex community, are being impacted in this. So those are the needs that we are responding to. It's not necessary that the essentializing woman have to be redefined in a new society. You understand what I'm saying? Because I am the chair of a department right now where the younger generation comes to me and say, we need to change the name. And I go and propose it, and there's a generation said, no, woman is not going anywhere. Wow. I'm serious. And so I said, yeah, but we need to, okay, how do you negotiate knowledge when we are, our society is changing constantly, where our students, you have students that are transgender that needs you to be, you know, how do you strategize to make your students, your male students, come to gender theory and learn about feminist struggles? You know, at the beginning I said, I'm not going to even mention feminism and gender theory, but let me ask you, do you believe in equality for all? Mm-hmm. Do you believe in equality, or when you lecture on sexuality? When do you know you were heterosexual? Let's talk about your heterosexuality. So when they all say, oh. So how do you reverse? How do you reverse knowledge? How do you bring knowledge in a way that students will, okay, well, yeah. You know, how they do they enter into the dialogue? Those are the ways that we need to constantly, as educators, as people that care, we constantly have to negotiate ways of disseminating the knowledge that we want to, because we are activists. I'm an activist in the classroom, but I have to be very strategic how I'm going to hit them, you know? Because I'm serious, you know? And I want them to respond to me. But, you know, I know that we have a responsibility. We have a responsibility that who are your students? What are their needs? And I think that's the way I respond to you.
But I think one of the things that I think is really interesting, getting back to what Laura's talking about, is also not shying away from the idea of feminism, because it's an intellectual and activist history. It's a tradition, mm-hmm. and I think that are the ways that we can the ways that women's studies becomes a place for these discussions around masculinity studies and transgender studies and activism and things to happen. The reason that that's possible is because of the really hard fucking work that feminists have done, mm-hmm. coming to the space of being able to understand intersectionality and epistemological and transsectionality, or whatever, you know? Anyways, I want to just leave, I won't say anything.
I don't know, maybe you wanted to enter into the dialogue. I know you have a lot of things to say as women's studies.
What I was going to say is a pedagogical tool for women's studies to bring in defense,
yes.
is very savvy. Because mm-hmm. it's a necessary thing that happens in the academy. The student has to rebel against you, the professor. They want to kill the mother.
Oh, yes, constantly, yes.
that can come in and embody the ideas of feminism in a way that seems radicalized to them, and it seems oppositional to the power structure of the academy, to the student, and they can respond to it in a
different way. Can I add something to the teaching? I don't know how many of you have read something on the concept of radical heterosexuality. Okay, well, it is a term now. When you present that to men and women, and then when you explain what radical heterosexuality is, someone that tries to understand what feminist struggles, someone that knows and can relate to the struggles of a transgender, and you put it like that, so everybody says, oh, yeah, well, I want to be radical. They say, I want to be a radical heterosexual. Well, who's a radical heterosexual? No, and I mean, there is a whole theory on radical heterosexuality that is a great tool to make your students listen to the other. You know? I'm serious. I'm no, anyway.
You have some comments, particularly in the absence of Jill here today. Uh-huh. Something that, you know, part of what we're recognizing here is
yes.
The extraordinary history of feminist scholarship on performance and feminist artists who have made performance. And really, you know, my own history in that was, and how I got to know Shauna, was as an assistant professor in a new city with another assistant professor working with a feminist theatre performance collective to make a place that we could imagine ourselves working and living. Mm-hmm. And part of the models in making that happen was Jill's critical book.
Yes.
Feminist Spectator was critically just come out. Karen's work that was getting a lot of attention both in the press and in critical scholarship. And in an event that, you know, I still kind of shuddered to look back at the ambition of what we did when we were assistant professors. Shauna found us and brought her work to that community. But we, you know, we learn from each other, we meet each other in these kind of informal collectives, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And just in the break before this session, I introduced Shauna to Leanne Fields. And we were talking about Linda Hart's first collection mm-hmm. of writing on feminist performance work, and Leanne made the point to Shauna that that collection produced 9 individual monographs on feminist performance mm. work. Mm-hmm. 9 of the contributors to that first collection mm-hmm. that that's made possible mm-hmm. turned into books.
Right.
That to me is collective work.
Yeah, exactly.
And yes, women's performance is a huge part of that, but it's a much bigger collective mm-hmm. practice that everyone
absolutely.
Is still engaged in. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. No, it seems to be going on right now. Yes, celebrate what feminism has done to bring people into the fold, and I think it's also appropriate for us to ask ourselves what some of the continuing challenges are. And what we've been talking about, sort of the increasing number of letters or words that go into constructing what it is that we need to think about when we're thinking about feminism. And certainly I think race and ethnicity is someplace that we still need to put pressure on ourselves as scholars and artists to think about inclusivity and to think about overlapping ways in which, and your comment actually also addressed ways in which seemingly distinct political issues actually are overlapping and need to be in dialogue and need to be considered together. So I just wanted to say that because, not to be too self-congratulatory, there's still a lot that we need to do, and that's certainly something that at the Journal we're constantly asking ourselves about. So, and I don't know if that will provoke anything or if there are other issues that people want to raise.
Sure. Earlier on, we were talking about things like blogging and finding alternative ways to do that. And in some ways, we're told the future is open access.
Right.
And that more or less coincides with the moment where one could say women have called us institutionalized by going for Routledge.
Exactly.
I say, I think it's a smart, savvy philosophy.
We struggle.
Unless you're now the commercial publisher for whom the bottom line is the bottom line, right? So I just wonder if you would talk about that and maybe in terms of how you're thinking about collective, what that means.
That was really hard, and we continue to struggle with this question, and absolutely, that's... We have 2 websites. One is our website, and one is the Routledge website, and there are certain ways in which we can make certain kinds of things available, but absolutely, we are part of now a structure, and we were already had certain attachments to NYU as an institution, which is also complicated. Mm-hmm. And the negotiations that go on. So this was one of the, without getting too specific, because nobody really wants to hear about the internecine struggles of the different journals at NYU and how all of that works. It's not that interesting, but I would like to say absolutely that we struggle constantly with how to balance these issues of survival, and this, it's kind of, There's this question of what professionalism. What does it mean to be peer-reviewed as a journal and all of that kind of thing? And that's kind of related to this issue of how do you do the best work as an artist or as a scholar? How do you do the best work that actually
will get you the kinds of attention and respect. And of course, at the same time, there's something very beautiful about the history of the journal. You know, back in the day when things were not peer-reviewed, when format was just this wide-open question, and we could just do things because aesthetically and politically the implications charmed us. and so it is a struggle because within the institutions within which we are all working, institutions where tenure depends, for example, on publication in peer-reviewed journals, we don't want to hold back our contributors in terms of their professionalization or the people on the collective, but it is a, it's a constant struggle for us. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I mean, there may be other people specific to the journal or who are experiencing this in their own institutions. It's really hard. And sort of our idealism often comes into conflict with those things. And the idea of having a non-hierarchical structure for the way in which the editorial board works within a system in which is hierarchical is very, you know, what it means to say graduate students and faculty members have the same say, but of course outside, when you walk outside of that room, somebody is on somebody's committee, or you know, those things are always in tension and need to be, you know, we need to ask ourselves if our idealism is really, we sometimes have to take reality into account. I don't know. That may sound obscure. But
those are the contradictions of being an academic, you know? Mm-hmm. Aren't we? We're all trapped in these contradictions, like, okay, well, I'm there. I want to be there. I want to be there to change things. But to get there is the thing, you know? I mean, moving the journal to Routledge is good, but it's also bad, you know, because there's no, you know, there is some, you know, you lose some of that collective effort that we're trying, that you're trying to.
Utopianism, really.
Utopian, yeah. So, but it's just, I think the, I mean, I call it sometimes cacademia. No, I don't really know. Sometimes, you know, we had a bet in our first book, me and my classmates, who will mention cacademia in their first book. That was a bet. No, because you know those are the games you play in academia, right? There's so many games we have to play in order to survive, especially if you're a woman and if you're a lesbian now, and if you believe me, there's a lot of layers of the game. Go back to performing, you know. Go back to perform. So anyway, yeah, it's contradictory. I think there's a lot of contradictions, but we have to constantly negotiate them.
Well, I think this forum is particularly marvelous because we get to see more people, and we, I think, would encourage even more participation via writing as well. So please send us your material,
send us your
thoughts and responses, and we're very intrigued in having more participation internationally. That's something we're really interested in.
Well, I have an experience. Do we still have a little bit more time here? Are we leaving now, Alex?
No.
30 minutes, I guess.
I have an example of just thinking about going from an individual project to a collective project, and I thought I would just share that. I do other work besides performance. I am a visual artist, and I recently have, for the past year, been creating a Holocaust memorial in Austria. Just for time, I'm not going to go into the whole research of how I came to do this, but I kind of initiated this project at Gusen, a camp probably about an hour outside of Linz, and it's I found out I created a memorial for children that had been killed by lethal injection at the site. And so I just started making this memorial on my own, and it's out of ceramics, and each piece is supposed to be to represent a heart, and then I started making the memorial. Through various circumstances then, it was in Austria, and then there was interest in it, and it eventually now is at at Goosen at the actual site. But when I started making it and I took this on, I made a decision that I thought I couldn't be just like Karen Finley being the person who's responding to the grief, you know, creating the work. So I started inviting other people, children, survivors, different people to take part in making it. And I started to, with the decisions, not to be relying on my decisions, even aesthetic, but to sort of form asking other people about the decisions and the creation of this work. And I think that the piece is going to be much more successful, or it's going to actually work, having as a collective as opposed to like an artist making the memorial. It still is, it isn't as easy as you think, because sometimes even, I just received, there is a letter that was received saying who owns the piece. And it's very difficult, it's for Austria or for them, the site, who is legally responsible for the piece. And so that's what I'm trying to deal with now. Who is legally responsible for the memorial? And that becomes an interesting question, too, in dealing with collectives about responsibility, about when you're dealing with really, governments, countries, institutions, memorials, traditions. And so I'm sort of trying to figure that out. So I just wanted to bring that up, with that idea of projects, when you're working on them, are they sometimes individual, or then is there a time that it becomes, hey, I'm going to open this up? And I'd like to try to be doing that that more. So I just wanted to bring that up. If people ever start in projects and doing things where in collectives or ever think about working in collectives, does anyone have any experience in working in collectives or thinking about that? I was interested as an artist in that question. Or if anyone has any.
I don't have an answer to that question, but I do want to respond to what you said a few minutes ago. Just this idea of individual projects versus collective projects and the process that the project undergoes in that transformation. Thinking about what you said about how you couldn't just have the project be a solo piece. It had to be something that you could just be Karen Finley doing this project. It had to move beyond that. Thinking through the Amplification article, which I haven't actually read, but from what you described, it sounds to me, at first, that was quite attractive to me, the idea of Emily Dickinson being very focused on her own work and being this sort of having feminist reading of her process. I'm starting to rethink now what that really means and if that really is enough. I wondered if you had responses to that in terms of, I know in my own work and in my own community, I engage with many women who focus are quite focused on their own personal work. So in a way, it would be their careers and professions can be seen as feminist, but on the other hand, is it really extending to the collective enough to call it feminist? Because there's an element of outreach that I think might be missing. I don't know if you can have responses to that, or anybody can respond to that. Something that I'm trying to work through.
I do. I don't know if Karen, you want to.
I'm listening to that. I think that to be thinking about. I'm just listening to what you're saying and listening in, and that's what I wanted to just be hearing when people issues and thoughts. Sometimes there isn't necessarily a conclusion. It's just hearing examples.
Just to say. I think all of us probably think about this and struggle with this. I love PSI as an organization. There are a couple of other professional organizations that I attend, most of them having to do with dance scholarship, because I work on dance, among other things. But
The Society of Dance History Scholars, Congress on Research in Dance, for those of you who have been to those organizations, it always is very striking that they're dominated by women. Okay, I don't really need to tell you why. I just say that. And amazing, when you go to those meetings, oftentimes you will find the president of the organization at the front table signing people in, passing out cards, and you know, sort of doing the, and making coffee, you know, like running around and doing things. And at one and the same time, I'm like, yes, isn't it great the way that women, you know, like do, they don't, they're not afraid to do the dirty work even though they're at the top of, you know, top of the hierarchy and they're, you know, all working together. And at the same time, there's something sort of disheartening about that, that, you know, women are sort of, assumed that the women will in fact get there with the paper towels and wipe up the mess. And you know, there's something that is great and not great about that. And there's something that I think all of us sort of struggle with as scholars, as artists. I also do creative work, and I struggle with this as, you know, in that context as well. The Emily Dickinson thing is really in my mind because I'm thinking about her in relation to my own writing, and she, you know, I'm working her into my writing, and that question of what it means, and the whole question of whether she, in fact, was so extraordinarily isolated, or whether, in fact, she had these affective relationships that were actually much more interesting than that. Very possibly of a lesbian nature, you know, all of those kind of things are, you know, that story needs to be and has been by many people recomplicated. But this thing of balancing the determination to be focused on your work and to create a body of your work which will stand and which you will leave behind, you don't want to lose that at the same time that you want to celebrate this, you know, the paper towels and the mm-hmm. and the coffee making and the passing out of the badges, and how you fit all that together is a question, and I find myself constantly going back and forth on that.
I think it also responds to the struggle of being a scholar and an activist. I mean, for us intellectuals and people that are writing dissertations, books, it's an isolated, you have to isolate yourself mm-hmm. for a while, do your writing. So you basically, how do you engage in a collective endeavor there? Mm-hmm. By connecting to those that are providing you with the ideas that came before where you are. How do you engage intellectually with others, you know? So that's a collective endeavor there. But you have to, it's very isolated. And there's also, that is a constant kind of a problem that exists in feminism, the activists and the theories, you know, and how do you bring them together, you know? Because you're talking about someone that, you know, that basically is doing both, you know, in a way. You know, but it has to do with that negotiation between being that scholar that you at one point have to isolate yourself and do the work. Because if not, you know, and it's very it's in isolation sometimes. And, you know, but you are kind of engaging with others, I think. You have to. It's part of our job.
I have to say that I find writing an extraordinarily erotic practice. it's ghosted by, or not even ghosted, it means dead people. It's lots of living and dead people in the room with you, and I find it actually a very, not so isolated. But at the same time, yes, indeed, you do need to have a quiet space and a room for its own.
Yeah,
I was thinking about original.
So.
Yeah, my name's Jess Falcon. I kind of want to go back to what Karen was talking about in terms of being a practitioner and looking at collectivity and stuff. And I'm a performance artist and a lesbian, so I have a lot of experience in collectives. And I lived in a, you know, collective where, you know, everyone did the dishes.
It's just like us.
You know, I was part of the Wild Cafe in New York, was the other collective. And feminist activist performance work and working collectives. And I feel like now more recently, and being here at PSI and paying so much attention to language and kind of really defining terms of like what we're talking about in terms of collectivity. I mean, I think I'm thinking much more in terms of my work now in terms of networks
and working in networks. And even when you're talking about like thinking of family or thinking of community, I think of those as networks, not so much in terms of collectives. Mm-hmm. And in the organizing work that I'm doing now, Take Back the Dyke, I'm really thinking about it in those terms, and in terms of working as networks and communities rather than a collective. And I also think that in the way that kind of, and I appreciate you bringing up issues of race and diversity and stuff in here, and I felt then there's like a kind of silence that happens. And in the collective work that I've done, and in, even in the organizing work that I'm doing now, that's where so much of the challenge is in terms of talking about those issues and things that I feel like we still are yet struggling to really kind of address, where so many of those challenges exist in the collective work. But to me, in terms of thinking about networks, too, it kind of creates the space for us to have our like sense of a different kind of sense of individuality and agency, and also just like this immediacy or this urgency that I feel right now in the activist kind of performance work that I'm doing, where we just have to fucking get it done. Mm-hmm. And it requires individuals to kind of step up and take a certain kind of leadership and make some decisions, mm-hmm. and kind of just start acting instead of kind of, you know, and again, I don't feel like it's an either or, but just in terms of thinking about strategies that can allow us just to kind of be really meeting the immediate, you know, just the immediacy of what's happening.
Yeah. Celeste.
We talked about radical heterosexuality. There's also, I guess, we could call it radical capitalism. A long-standing model of a collective called the corporation. Yeah. And the corporation is something that you form when you sign up, whether it's nonprofit or for-profit. You set the bylaws, you set the structure, and the corporation owns the work. And I'm sure lots of people who form nonprofits, whether it's a dance company or a theater company, and the question of ownership is absolutely collective. So no individual owns it, it's the collective itself that owns it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My name is Shawna Dempsey. I work in a micro collective, too, but over 20 years. It's 22 years now. And we have found we share all the work, and we don't describe the division of labor. Because when we have described the division of labor, people ascribe a hierarchy to that. Mm-hmm. So it's Lori's brain, Shawna's the body, or Shawna's the writer, Lori's just the technician. Mm,
yeah.
Do members of your group fluctuate? Do people come in and out, or has it been the same group that stayed constant?
Two. I was just talking about a collective of two that I admire the other, just last night, who go by, one is the beauty and one is the beast, but it's highly ironic, but that's a kind of an interesting division of labor. Yeah.
So I consider myself the child of a long Latin American tradition of theater collective specifically, although there is also a tradition of visual arts of collective. And it many started in the 60s and 70s, and some survived, like Julia Scani in Peru and La Candelaria in Colombia. Ironically, I'm a solo artist. I'm involved in many artists also as a collaborator of collective creation. And I write about Papel Machete. I received a paper about their work. It's a street Puerto Rican street theater collective or ensemble. I'm not sure how the terms kind of intertwine. They have been working for 4 years and being they were not theater artists. They decided to become to use theater to call attention to their activist work and politic work. And, well, one of the things that happens is that when you're in a collective, that means that the process will be longer. because many things will be discussed for hours before getting, you know, everybody. It's also a big group, and it changes sides asking that question. So some members have been there since the beginning. Some came later. There's also people like me that will, whenever I'm on the island, then I collaborate with them or participate in different capacities. So there is malleability to the group, and that sometimes facilitates movement. It sometimes makes it slower to instill. Be successful. Sometimes it makes us so slow that they have to decide to put things aside and not work on something. And for example, recently there was this discussion. They made a piece that was not a street piece, but a shadow puppet show. And one of the members is a very talented visual artist, so he made most of the cutouts. And then after the several presentations. Some members wanted to post them on YouTube, and the artist didn't want to. And the funny thing is that it wasn't for individual reasons. He thought that this work was supposed to be live. But then at some point, when the struggle was there, he claimed, well, I made that. You know, I made that. It's my work, and I said no. And that sparked all the discussions that I think it's very interesting. So they have to reinvent, I guess, themselves all the time.
Mm-hmm. There's a question.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Okay. Here, just because I said yes. Yes. Hi.
For myself, my name is Anna Bruce, I'm a sound artist, and an important part of my practice, because I'm a big media artist, is often to be the only woman in the technical capability in the theater, or the only woman who's going to plug in my own rules on stage.
My work is around grief and looking at public performance interventions as a way of kind of activating grief for the, you know, what Judith Butler calls the derealized other, you know, so, and it really was born of, you know, living for myself, living in the States for a long time while we were active. I mean, we're always active for work, but, you know, sometimes it's covertly and sometimes a little bit overtly, and the kind of impossible juxtaposition of going on with day-to-day life in the midst of all these deaths that are not, that we read about in the paper and we can't mourn. But one of the things that I'm thinking about in terms of this tension between the individual and the collective, in particular around grieving, is the way in which, you know, a lot of the dominant West group has been so interiorized and individualized. And in my own work and trying to think about it, you know, I have this idea about the need for it to be collective for me. But my experience is really both, first, as Butler talks about, that it's about the ungrievable other, like how do I even access that? You know, so there's this layer of the numbness, but also this real tension of like how do I deal with that really, with that tension between the collective, like that may be a goal or an objective, Mm-hmm. And so how, in terms of performance and in terms of art, how to address that through the form, which is the beauty of art, I think, is that it's not only about the goal of where one wants to go, but how form and function meet to speak to what is. And so I've been thinking a lot more lately about working with the internet, which is so not effective, so that's like rocking my world already as you think about that. But because of that side of like it as a possible public location that could invite a collectivity, but that also works with the tension of the real aloneness and isolatedness of being with this kind of grief that has no name or has no, is not memorialized. So the non-memorialized of it, and others, which are multiple, through ancestors.
Thank you. That was beautifully said and worded. Thank you.
Somebody wanted to talk.
I think this might be our last question. Is that right? Okay, yeah. So maybe we're getting to the end of our time, but yes, please. Is this an appropriate image to say? I must say, from my perspective, really beautiful example today of a participatory dialogue. And as I said, we didn't want to begin and end with just a very restricted notion of what this panel has been about. But indeed, please do send Women in Performance your work. Check out our website and keep the dialogue happening. And thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for coming to the party.